The ultimate sign of failure is that when he died, you know, a third of his country was occupied by a foreign force.
That was Sean McGlynn on the French invasion of England in 1216.
It's very useful to do a history of the world in order to reflect on this, because you're then reminded of what shorter period the North American European predominance really is in terms of world history as a whole. It's a relatively brief period of time.
And that was Arne Westad on Writing World History. Hello, and welcome to the History Extra podcast. My name is Rob Attar, and I'm the editor of BBC History Magazine, which is the UK's best-selling history magazine. You can find it in all good newsagents and on subscription. See historyextra.com/subscribe-today for subscription deals. We also have digital editions available for the iPad, Kindle, Kindle Fire, and Google Play. For details of our digital formats, including price, content, and availability, head to historyextra.com/digital. In May 1216, Prince Louis of France, the heir to the French throne, arrived at the Isle of Thanet looking to seize the crown from England's much-maligned monarch, King John. Our section editor, Charlotte Hodgman, caught up with Sean McGlynn to discover why this invasion is so often overlooked, and finds out more about one of England's most hated monarchs.
King John is probably one of England's most controversial monarchs, but how did he, as the youngest son, come to the throne in the first place?
Well, he was the youngest of four sons of Henry II. In fact, there was a fifth who died much younger. Count Geoffrey of Brittany and Henry the Young King died, one in a tournament.
Okay.
In a tournament, and the other of illness, probably dysentery. So that left Richard the Lionheart as king. Richard the Lionheart did not have any children, so it fell to the youngest of the line, John, to become king. So there was little dispute over him being accepted as king in England. It's more in France and Brittany where Arthur of Brittany, Geoffrey's son, was deemed to be the heir to the throne.
Which leads me to my next question, actually, which was sort of within 3 years of him coming to the throne. He didn't start too well because he was accused of the death of his 15-year-old nephew, who just mentioned Arthur of Brittany. What would he have actually gained for murdering Arthur? And do you think he actually orchestrated this?
What he have gained, he would have taken away from Philip II of France, Philip Augustus, who was John's keen enemy, a key ally of the King of France, who was using Arthur to cause disloyalty amongst John's subjects. So he had that to gain. He didn't have a lot to gain from killing him in the way he did because it backfired. He may have thought he was getting rid of an opponent, just like this was really a forerunner of the princes in the Tower with Richard III. It really was. I mean, nobody, you know, what actually happened. Did he orchestrate it? Almost certainly. Again, we have no hard and fast evidence, but he was, when Arthur was captured, he was put in prison at Rouen, and there's all kinds of conspiracy theories and ideas what happened to him. One is that Arthur was actually castrated so that he wouldn't be able to have any issue to have further contenders for the throne, and that Arthur died from the shock. Another less likely one is that John rode him out into the middle of the River Seine and then killed him. I don't think John had the strength or the courage to have done that. But the one that a lot of people favour, historians favour, is that in a drunken rage, John just went down to the cell and killed him and disposed of him like that. But it's very, very interesting. Years later, John mistreats one of his leading barons, William de Brose, and his family. He has a charge that William owes him money. William does a runner. His wife and child are taken into John's custody in Corfe Castle and are starved to death. And there's lurid tales of the mother being found in the son's lap, gnawing at her son's cheek for food. But the thing is, William de Brose was with John at the time of Arthur's disappearance.
Right.
And it's believed that Arthur knew where the bodies were buried, as it were. So that when John went to William and his wife said, we're not going to give you our son as a hostage because we know what happened to Arthur. So it's almost as if John was trying to get rid of anybody connected with the death of Arthur. So the combination of the death of Arthur and then mistreating one of the most powerful barons in the reign were two really serious mistakes in John's reign, which put a lot of people against him.
So what was John doing in France at the time of that? Because you said he was actually in France when his nephew was killed.
This was before he lost Normandy, the Duchy of Normandy. Mm. So there's warfare going on. He'd actually just won a great victory at Mirebeau in 1202. And it was a tremendous victory, probably the most important English victory at that time before Crecy in many ways. But when John had success, he blew it. He always did the wrong thing afterwards. He couldn't consolidate it. So he mistreated his prisoners so that when the French invaded Normandy, the relatives of those prisoners in Normandy went over to Philip. And then he almost certainly killed Arthur.
And how... What were reactions to this at the time? Did people believe that he had actually done this?
Well, he certainly made an implacable enemy of the Bretons because, you know, he had killed their lord. And indeed, you know, he was nobility.
Yeah.
So for that to happen was serious. And it upset a lot of people in England. Maybe they weren't that worried about Arthur himself, but the thought at the back of their minds is, if he can do this to such a powerful figure...
Mm. What else could he do?
Exactly. Mm. What will he do to us?
He's famously been given the nickname at the time of John Softsword. Can you kind of just explain how that came about and what it actually means?
Yeah, sure. This is from the Latin Molly Gladium, Softsword. This came about after the signing of the treaty with France in 1200. John had just come to power and he signed this peace treaty with France. And he actually paid over a large sum of money as part of the treaty to the King of France. And people started speaking of him quite disparagingly as soft sword, you know, scared of war, wanting to find peace. One or two chroniclers liked the fact that he had opted for peace rather than for war and said that actually soft sword should be considered, you know, not a
compliment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it stuck with him. And as he went to go on and lose things, you know, as he did all the time, it really becomes a very good nickname for him.
And why did England's barons choose to revolt against John in 1215? And what sort of support did they have? Because not only did he have problems in France initially, he then kind of had a sort of civil war going on in England as well.
Yes, well, there's all kinds of reasons given for the barons revolting. One of the reasons is that because John kept losing his wars, he kept needing money to try and regain the lands in France. So he was taxing very heavily and very, very arbitrarily. And a lot of the barons were in debt to the crown, so they didn't like that. That's one thing. Another thing was they just simply didn't like to see good money being thrown after bad. You know, any money to support John in war was going to be lost.
Yeah.
Never succeeded. But also there's the whole level of arbitrary government, almost like a dictatorship. No one knew where they stood with John. He would sell justice to the highest bidder and things like that.
Yeah.
But also there's a personal side of him, apart from being despotic and tyrannical. There are rumours, which are probably fairly justified, that he was rather free and easy with some of the barons' wives and daughters.
Right.
So it's a huge insult.
Yeah.
Now, again, some historians think, well, that's probably exaggerated to try and get people to support the rebellion against him. But if you're a great lord, to admit that your wife has been raped or your daughter been assaulted by John is a terrible thing to admit. So there's probably a lot of truth in that. So he just alienated everybody. He had minimal manpower skills, management skills, you know. So
he doesn't have very good people skills
exactly.
By the sounds of it.
terrible skills. And of course, as a king, you need that for patronage, for, you know, soft-talking your barons and everything. But people didn't know where they stood with him. Waste of money, poor, you know, relations with the barons and mistreating them. So he did very little that was right as far as they were concerned.
And probably the most famous thing to come out of this episode is Magna Carta, which probably most people have heard of. Did he actually want to sign this? And did it do anything to improve his reputation once he had?
Not immediately, no. His reputation for Magna Carta as a good thing comes much later. Mm. At the time, he didn't want to seal it or anything have anything to do with it. He was There's accounts of him going back and gnawing at the rushes and, you know, on the floor because he's so enraged by it. But everybody at the time really expected it to be a stopgap measure, just as a kind of a momentary truce. Everyone expected King John to renege on the deal, and he did. He got the Pope to say it was done under duress and that it wasn't valid.
Yeah.
So it was a very short-term measure. Longer term, though, it has much, much stronger effect. It was only lasted a few weeks when it signed in June 1215, but actually it was reintroduced then in Bristol in November 1216, and from then it's been fairly continuous. It's been reissued in various forms, but certain aspects of it have been dropped out. The most famous one being of the first Magna Carta was the last clause, the security clause, which says the 25 men of the realm should oversee what the king was doing and be the judge of what he was doing. So John became a bit like an executive officer.
Yeah.
And then it was the barons pulling the string. That one was dropped. but it helped John in the short term. The reissue of it in Bristol in 1216 was more successful because then by that time, John had just died in October.
Right.
And then so people felt much reassured that John was gone. We have Magna Carta. So it helped the royalists to regain their initiative in some ways.
So I guess that reaction to him sort of going back on his word after Magna Carta didn't go down too well with the barons.
No. And they weren't expecting him. They knew John. So it was just a momentary pause to take breath. John was a problem. It wasn't really, Magna Carta wasn't going to solve it. Getting rid of John would solve it.
And how did Prince Louis of France come to be involved in what was essentially an English conflict between King John and the barons?
Well, the barons needed outside help. John had the majority of the castles, you know, royal castles, which were strong in England. And because they had state finances being poured into them, they were the bigger ones, the fortifications. So they had nearly as many, three times as many castles as the barons did, and the stronger castles. So they needed outside help and also a figurehead of stature. So Prince Louis was asked, would you like to become King of England? And he said, yes, please. So he came over with a force of 1,200 knights, which is enormous, 700, 800 ships. At one point, over half the barons in England paid homage to Prince Louis as King Louis of England. But they needed his support against John.
And King Alexander of Scotland famously came down to play homage to Louis. Why do you think he wasn't an option to come and take the throne?
He was considered, that's a good question, he was considered by some to be an option, especially some of the barons up north who had close family ties with Alexander. When he was very young, he is still a teenager, but France was just so powerful.
Yeah.
It really was so powerful. And Louis was going to be the king of France as well at one point. So it was just the bigger muscle, basically.
John died in 1216 of dysentery. What impact did that have on Louis's attempts to take the English throne?
Well, Louis lost his greatest asset when John died because John was a divisive figure. And so with John gone and Magna Carta reissued, loads of barons thought that it's safe to go back to the royalist cause. The new King of England was a 9-year-old boy, Henry III. No blame could be attached to him. Their positions and influence could be reintroduced with the new realm, because John, they were so implacably opposed to John that there's going to be no leeway. But with Henry III, it's a clean slate almost. So that really did change the situation. Although, at the end of the day, it was military force that compelled Louis to withdraw at the Battle of Lincoln in May 1217, when the French and the barons had a very heavy defeat. And then that really pushed everyone back over, well, most people back over to the royalists.
So Louis wasn't prepared to accept that Henry III was, you know, was the new king that John had gone.
He had invested so much by this time. I mean, he was in England for best part of 18 months, a year and a half. The barons had been holding London since May 1215, so London was held for over 2 years.
Yeah.
So they weren't in a weak position by any means. They had a lot to offer in terms of strength and political force. So Louis wasn't prepared to just let it go so easily when he saw there's still an opportunity.
I know lots of historians don't like answering these sorts of questions, but what do you think would have happened if John hadn't died when he did? Do you think that he could have defended the throne from the French?
No, I don't think so. Because as I said earlier, John was part of the problem. the longer John went on, he didn't show any signs at the end of being any better than he was at the beginning. He refused to take firm military actions. As I said, London was in the French and rebels' hands for over 2 years.
Mm.
For that time, John would go ravaging around the country, burning places, you know, taking the war to his own people and making everybody suffer. But if he had grasped the thorn of London and got rid of London straight away, then that would have been headquarters gone for the French and the invasion was likely to have come to an end. So he didn't have the military commitment to defeat the French. And it's likely Louis's position would have stayed strong with more people going over to him. So it's hard to know what would have happened. Maybe the best option for John would have been a continuation of a divided country with him in power in the north and the west, and Louis in power on the richest third of the country.
So essentially it could have been a second Norman conquest.
Absolutely. It was very close to it. Mm. It really was at some points. As I said, over half the barons supported Louis at one point.
What about the sort of the common people? What do we know anything about them? How they saw it?
No, we don't really have any information.
No.
They would want to keep their heads down for most of the time. But the people in London were generally pro-rebel, pro-baron. Elsewhere, they were likely to be the victims. But there is an interesting case of when the French were defeated at the Battle of Lincoln, they made a retreat back to London, to the safehold of London.
Yeah.
And on the way back, ordinary peasants and people attacked them and killed them. Now, that may have been revenge for what had happened earlier, but also to try and plunder their goods, just as the French and the barons had plundered the goods off the people. So yeah. It's probably trying to get some money back. People were encouraged to fight, though, for their country. So there's a patriotic element here, which, again, historians don't tend to always see as being a phenomenon in the early 13th century. But there are definite appeals to protect England, protect your land and your loved ones from the foreigner. Mm. So they were motivated to fight to defend their country.
I mean, it doesn't really sound like John had a lot going for him, really, in terms of being a king. But was he really as bad as he's made out to be?
Yes. He was always deemed a bad king until just after World War II. Then there's a reaction against military history and the like, understandably, and more interest taken in bureaucratic records. And John was a great bookkeeper.
Mm.
So historians started thinking, well, he looks after the records well. It shows firm government, close eye on government. But, you know, a king was meant to be more than a bookkeeper. He had to rule his people. He had to defend his people.
Yeah.
And the ultimate sign of failure is that when he died, you know, a third of his country was occupied by a foreign force.
Yeah.
And he was outside of London. So he failed in the most basic objective of a king, to defend your people. But there are attempts to make him sound like he wasn't that bad. But the fact that he was at home looking after the books was a sign of failure because he should have been in France.
Yeah.
But he lost to France. That forced him to come home. He was a stay-at-home king.
Yeah. And how did his contemporaries view him? I mean, famously, there are kind of records from when he died, people kind of almost celebrated the fact that he'd gone. Was that the case the whole time with everybody?
They didn't worry about speaking ill of the dead.
No,
absolutely not. They're, you know, sinking into hell and befouling hell. Yeah. You know, that's what John was up to. He had a bad press from early on. Even before he was king, he had a reputation for treachery and changing sides. He'd rebelled against his father. When Richard was in prison, he tried to take over the country. So he had a poor reputation even before he became king.
Mm.
But what's telling and what people miss is a couple of things. One is that they say that the chroniclers don't like him because they're monks and John had the interdict of the church and broke away from the church and was excommunicated. But some of these monks were actually very well informed and had patrons who were very close to the centre of things. The one that's overlooked. But secondly, what is often missed is that many of the sources which were written from John's side, from people involved in John's side, actually say he was a bad man and a bad king. And that's often overlooked.
Mm.
So you don't get many people supporting and praising him, even from his own side. They say he simply had too many bad qualities.
And we've mentioned that this could have feasibly been a second Norman conquest. Why do people remember 1066 and not 1215? Why do people sort of overlook this period?
Well, it still amazes me that it's overlooked. I remember being an undergraduate and studying this period, and then there's two or three lines in our 400-page book saying, oh, the French invaded England, then got kicked out. I think there are two main reasons. One is that it comes at the end of John's reign. So Magna Carta takes all the focus.
Mm.
So Magna Carta gets all the attention. And then John dies, and that's forgotten about. And the other thing is, it's because it falls in between two reigns. It comes to the end of John's reign and then starts at the new reign. But the new reign is also a minority. So Henry III is king in name, but not in practice. Right. So you don't have a forceful, strong character taking over.
That was Sean McGlynn, lecturer in history for the Open University and the University of Plymouth at Strode College. Sean's book, Blood Cries Afar, The Forgotten Invasion of England, 1216, is published by the History Press. And Sean also wrote a piece about King John for our May issue, which is still available as a back issue, as well as on the iPad and some other digital formats. Before our next interview, I'd like to quickly mention that tickets are now on sale for our History Weekend Festival. It's taking place in the historic Wiltshire town of Malmesbury from the 25th to the 27th of October, and will include talks from some of Britain's leading historians, including Max Hastings, Michael Wood, Dan Snow, Susanna Lipscomb, Dominic Sandbrook, and Kate Williams. For the full lineup and for ticket information, please visit historyweekend.com. Professor Arne Westad is the author of the sixth edition of The Penguin History of the World, which builds on the work of J.M. Roberts to cover topics from ancient civilizations to 21st century economic problems. Professor Westad spoke to our books editor, Matt Elton, about the challenges of writing whole world history and what he thinks it can tell us about the course of human civilization.
So how did you get involved with the project to write a history of the world?
I first read John Roberts' History of the World when I was a teenager. I grew up in a small town on the west coast of Norway. And it was one of those books that really influenced me in the sense that I started thinking seriously about studying history and then later on actually becoming an historian, someone who worked on researching and writing history. So this is a book that had a lot of significance to me in many different ways. And then when I was offered by Penguin many years later to have a first crack at this after John died in 2003, it was something I simply couldn't turn down. So we did it for the fifth edition with based on John's notes and did an updated version, mainly working on the latter parts of the manuscript. And then for this edition, we then decided to do a complete overhaul to present it as a new world history. Actually, part of the text are still similar to what John Roberts wrote when he first published in 1976. But this is a very new take on many of the core questions that relate to world history. So it's been a great pleasure working with this. It's been absolutely fantastic, and it's something I enjoyed tremendously.
So how do you go about choosing what makes it into a book with such a broad focus?
Well, that's the difficulty. I mean, you have to start, of course, in this case, with the text that already exists, the text that is there, which has been tremendously successful, of course. It's been almost certainly the most read history of the world for the past generation. So you have to start with that, and then you have to think about how have our views of history in a broader sense changed in the last generation, last 40 years. So you have to decide which parts of the work that you really want to look at to begin with in terms of revision. And I kept the basic structure in place. But of course, our knowledge has expanded enormously, and the discussions, the debates about history have also expanded enormously during that time. So, for instance, I decided to look at much of prehistory and early human history again, in light of what we know today. I wanted to have more in there about interconnectivity of various sorts between various groups of people, between various civilizations and countries. More about migration. I wanted to do more on the history of women, the history of young people, where we have gained an enormous amount of knowledge over the past generation. So these were the kinds of ideas that I went to the writing with. But then, of course, you have to do a great deal of reading and a great deal of research in order to flesh this out, in order to figure out, you know, what is there that is new? What is there that we really need to focus in on the discussion of today?
Okay, so which sources did you use to find out what to include then?
What I did three things to begin with. I read quite a number of overviews that are available for different parts of human history, recently published by other historians, to get a sense of what the key issues and the key debates are. So that's the starting point. You know, for a history of this kind, you don't really go back to the archives or anything like that. You simply can't. But you have to look at what is being published by others and what is reasonably up to date, both in terms of what actually goes into it, in terms of information, but more importantly to me, what the key debates are among historians, and particularly historians who write for a broader audience. So that was the first point. And then I started looking at those fields that really needed to be extended, some of which I mentioned already. But I also wanted to do, for instance, more on non-European history. John, after all, was first and foremost an historian of Europe, and it's very clear that his history of the world is influenced by that. I'm an historian of China, primarily, in terms of my own orientation and starting point. So obviously I wanted to cover that a bit more in depth. I wanted to cover Southeast Asian, South Asian history, Middle Eastern history. So I had to find a framework in which to fit that in with the overall structure of the book. And then finally, what I had to do is to seek some form of balance. You know, I mean, I wanted to make sure that the reader was able to follow these various developments, both when they were separate in the early part of human history and as they became increasingly interconnected. So you have to develop a number of themes that you wanted to work on that run through maybe particularly the last 2,500 years or so of the human experience and all the way up to today. And I think in order to do that, you have to some extent to start with what are the key issues for our world today? What is it that has made us develop into the kind of human race that we are today? So you have to have some priorities with regard to that. And those priorities are, in many, many cases, unabashedly presentist. They are about how our world today has been created.
That's really interesting. Thank you. Something that did strike me was that the idea of nation has survived when things like class and religion have survived less well. Why do you think that is?
I think in overall terms, we are still in a period of history in which different kinds of concepts of nation are very, very important. I think the two main reasons for that. I mean, the first one is the takeover of various forms of European nationalism, concepts of nationalism in various parts of the world, which went through the decolonization period. Now, this has always been contentious. It's always been problematic. It is quite clear that the ideas of a nation, and particularly the idea of a nation state that developed in Europe from the early 19th century or late 17th century on, doesn't really fit much of the historical situation that we are in today. It doesn't even fit it for Europe, as we know, in terms of the many attempts at integration that have been going on, particularly over the last two generations. But it's a very forceful idea. It's the idea about the collective, about serving the greater good for a defined group of people that you set up as a nation. But one always has to be aware that those definitions are very contentious. They are very much discussed and very much debated. So I think we are still within a period where the nation plays an enormously important role as a concept for a lot of people in various places around the world. But there are competing concepts as well, and some of those have become stronger, of course, over the past generation.
That's something that I was going to touch on. I mean, how do you think the study of history has changed recently, and what do you think the factors are that have caused that change?
I think for many reasons. I mean, one of the most important reasons is that, you know, we've simply got access to a lot more source material today about various groups of people and various kinds of history than what we've had before. I mean, people started looking for these during parts of the 20th century. For instance, we know a great deal more about the history of women than what we used to do. And that has a lot to do, of course, with what has happened to the status of women overall in the 20th century and up to today, that historians have been looking for this immense change that has meant, for the first time in most societies, the full participation of women in society and politics. So people have been looking for that and looking for the historical origins of that. And then secondly, I think it is important to try to think about the development of the concept of world history. The emphasis on different kinds of connectedness, the emphasis on different kinds of comparative history that have developed, particularly over the last generation or so, been tremendously important, at least to me, in writing this book, that you try to understand how different aspects of human history connect, how they are dealt with. A sound degree of skepticism about the primacy that was generally given to the state and the genesis of the state, the emphasis on different parts of what I guess today we would call civil society in various forms. And maybe first and foremost, this overall emphasis that I hope you will find in this book when you read it, on different kinds of development, that there isn't one sort of logical given form of economic or social or political development, but there have been very many different alternatives that have developed in different ways throughout human history. I think those are the main kinds of development that we have seen over the past generation or so in terms of how historians work.
Are there any areas in which you disagreed with John Roberts?
Well, there are a few. I mean, I already mentioned that John was primarily an historian of Europe, though he did do a fantastic job for when he wrote this book in picking up what was new in non-European history as well. I think if there is one main aspect of this that I would underline, besides that difference in orientation between where we are coming from as historians, it would probably be John's sense that much of the what he would call the rise of the West, the predomination of Europe and particularly European forms of thinking and economic practices, have very deep roots going back to at least late antiquity. I'm not so sure about that. I see many of the changes that came to set off the direction of European predominance really belong in the middle part of the last millennium, sort of the 15th, 16th, even early 17th centuries, simply because the differences in terms of ability to control large amounts of territory, differences in terms of economy and differences in terms of technology, weren't really all that great, for instance, if you compare Europe and China before then. So I see a bit more contingency, I see a bit more sort of rapid development of differences and divergences than what John sees. That said, it is also interesting to note that in his own work, he was always very open in terms of understanding these many-ended, you know, very open kinds of development that took place in human history. He was never teleological. I mean, never believed that one set of developments could only have one outcome. And that is something that we most definitely agree on, something that I think makes this, in its first version, such a great book.
Just out of interest, did you catch Andrew Marr's recent BBC series on the history of the world?
Yeah, I watched some of it. I didn't, unfortunately, get to watch all of it, but I watched some of the programmes.
What did you think of it?
I think it is very good. I mean, for someone who knows how difficult it is to do a history of the world now after having completed this revised version of Penguin's History of the World, I think he did quite a good job of it. I mean, there are different ways in which to present this. And the most important thing, I think, of all, for anyone who is writing world history, is to be able to engage a large audience. And he was certainly able to do that. I mean, we would disagree on a few things. We would disagree, for instance, again, on how did European predomination came into being. I would be very uncertain, for instance, about some of the things that he had to say about China and South Asia in the broader development of human history. I think some aspects of what I call the great conveyor belt of the last 2,000 years, Central Eurasia, some of that was left out. But overall, I think this was a job pretty well done and extremely well presented.
We've touched there on China quite a bit. The shift towards the Eastern Hemisphere that we're seeing happening at the moment, particularly after the global financial crisis, is that something that you see continuing?
Yes. I mean, I think the global financial crisis is just a symptom of underlying changes that have been going on for quite some time. It doesn't just have to do with China. It has to do with creating a more multipolar world, a world that is more complex, more composite. It's very useful to do a history of the world in order to reflect on this, because you're then reminded of what short a period the North American European predominance really is in terms of world history as a whole. It's a relatively brief period of time where productivity, productive capacity, technology, all of this seemed for a much longer time to prioritize Asia over Europe. Not difficult to understand when you think about where the overall balance of the world's population has been over the last two millennia. So I think we're sort of shifting back there now, in a sense, not just to Asia, although Asia is going to be at the center of this, I think, but also onto a much more complex world, a much more composite world than what we have seen during the period of European imperial control and the Cold War period that followed that.
Are there any themes that you think recur across the book?
Yes, I think there are a few. I mean, one of them is, of course, the tremendous human capacity for change. One of the things that really strikes you when you work on human prehistory, for instance, is how certain inventions, how certain social formations came to predominate not just in one area, but relatively rapidly, when you think about it in historical time, in other areas as well. The ability to embrace change, to make it part of who we are, I think that's something that you find throughout all historical epochs. Another thing is people's willingness and interest in traveling, in moving about. And this is something that we found a great deal more on over the past half generation or so. Think, for instance, about how our understanding now of the compositeness of human genetics, of human DNA, has changed over the past, past decade or so. We know much more about where people come from and how they've interacted over time. And that includes a great deal of movement, of migration, over very long distances, starting way back in prehistory and lasting up to our own time. And then finally, the preoccupation with ideas, with trying to put things together in a broad sense, of trying to make sense of, to put it in a sort of more semi-religious sense, what we are doing here. What is the origin, what is the original aspect of understanding the human position in the world or perhaps in the universe. That's something that's always been with us. It's something that's not going to go away anytime soon.
And finally, what impressions about history and, I guess, human nature do you hope that people come away from the book with?
I first and foremost hope that reading a book like this, they would be interested in reading more, in finding out more about the various epochs in human history, because a one-volume history of the world, however comprehensive it is, and this one is, for one-volume history, pretty comprehensive, can never do justice to the complexities and the intricacies of human history. So I hope it will be a starting point, for particularly for young people, to read more about history in the broad sense for the various time periods that we try to cover. I also hope that it will be an instrument for people to think about history more critically than what we generally do, to think about where our own world today is coming from, to think about alternative outcomes, about alternative endings, to think about, our own ancestors, what they had to deal with, what kind of choices that they had to make in a very concrete manner in most cases. That's the kind of history that I hope this will be.
That was Professor Arne Westad. The Penguin History of the World, 6th edition, is out now, published by Allen Lane. And that's almost all for this week. Do get in touch with your views on podcast@historyextra.com, and we may well read out some of your messages in future episodes. You can also follow us on Twitter @HistoryExtra, and you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/HistoryExtra. Next time, we'll be heading off to London to meet some of the Horrible Histories gang, so do join us for that. The History Extra weekly podcast is recorded in Bristol and produced by Jack Fletcher.